Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Glad that you could join us for day two of Crazy Stories. We want to welcome all of you who skipped us to go to Nadia yesterday. We don't take that personally at all, but we're glad you're here for today. And we talked yesterday about just this simple idea that the Bible just has these odd, crazy stories that, as people of faith who've been around the Bible for a long time, we just take as normal, everyday stories. So you might remember earlier, I guess sometime last year when the Noah movie came out, and there were a lot of people, maybe people that you know, maybe you yourselves were kind of freaked out by the Noah movie, and I didn't go see it in the theater, but people kept telling me about it, and there were talking rocks and all these things and going on, and people were like, what is going on with what they've done to the Noah story? And I had this internal dialogue with myself as they were speaking, like, do you know the regular Noah story? Like, that's a pretty crazy story in and of itself. So the talking rocks, that's just sort of an add-on, but it doesn't make the story any less insane in our world. And so we just wanted to share for a couple of days some of these crazy stories with the belief that God does things in ways that we see as odd or strange, because he's trying to get across a point that we might not get if he didn't do something that was odd or strange. Something to get our attention, especially as 21st century Christians, where everything in life is extreme, that we just live for the extreme. Like, when you turn on your cable news, what they are trying to do, whether you acknowledge it or not, is give you an extreme experience. Something that is memorable and remarkable. And that's because we're just made the way we're made, and we respond to those sorts of things. So you might remember yesterday, for those of you who were here, that we walked through the story of Judah and Tamar as sort of the crazy story and what it teaches us about Jesus. And I told you about my oldest daughter. And John and I are both, for fans of the West Wing, what you would call Abu El-Banat. Which, if you remember that episode of The West Wing, Abu El-Banat means father of daughters. So, when we were talking about Judah and Tamar and this idea, like, this is not the story that we tell at bedtime. But my daughter's 11, and we've slowly been peeling the onion on the topic about human sexuality and sex. And then last night, thankfully I was here when the dam broke and she asked her mother, okay, give me the rest of the story. And so my wife, who is a trained therapist, thank goodness, was able to walk her through the parts of it that we hadn't talked about before in more explicit terms. And we've always been that family, like, body parts have names, we're going to use the real names. God doesn't make junk. People's body parts aren't junk. You can't call, or all these other sorts of things. And so they walk through the whole thing, and my oldest daughter, Malia, just says, that's weird. And Rochelle says, that's okay for you to think it's weird. And in her fashion, she goes, well, can we stop talking about this now? So, yeah, we can stop, and it's bedtime, and when I'm away, my youngest daughter sleeps in the bed with my wife, and my oldest daughter makes what she calls her grand pallet on the floor and lays down there, and my wife's laying down on the floor, and they just cuddle for a while after this conversation about sex and sexuality. And then she hops up and flips on the light, and she goes, is it okay if I think that that's weird? Or she says, yeah, it's okay if you think it's weird. You won't always think it's weird. She turns off the light and goes back to bed. And they cuddle some more. And a few minutes later, she hops up again. And she would hate that I'm telling you this story. And turns on the light and she says, does that mean sexual abuse is when someone forces someone else to do that? And so they sit and talk about that for a while. And I just walked all of us through the story of Judah and Tamar. And I thought, man, it is so important that we have the whole story. and not leave out parts because we think that they are strange or weird. Or don't sell VeggieTale videos. And John and I both, to some degree, live in the world of Christian publishing, which means that we constantly get notes back and forth from editors about not offending you all with the truth of what's in the Bible. But we need the whole story, because the whole story is the only way that we know who we are and how to be. And we want to share some more of those stories. I'm at this little weird, quirky church in Temple, Texas, and everybody thinks that, you know, we're actually cooler than we are, because their preacher wears a bow tie and we do jeans and we are an odd duck in many ways. And folks label us contemporary at the Vine, and we're really not. We're very old church in practices. I tell her our biggest growing demographic from the day that I landed there haven't been people in their 20s and 30s and 40s. It's been baby boomers whose kids have just recently left the house. And our worship service is pretty liturgical. I was in a class earlier this morning and someone finished reading the Bible and she says, the word of the Lord. And I'm the only one in there who says, thanks be to God. Because that's what we do at the Vine. And we say the Lord's Prayer together. We have a liturgy around the Lord's Supper. And so as John walks us through a crazy story this morning, I wanted you to hear one of my favorite poems. And at the Vine, we share poetry in our worship service because we like the indirect nature of God. And this is one of Wendell Berry's. And I would stop at the end and explain it to you, except that's just not what you do with poetry. Poetry is like, if you have to explain a poem, it's like having to explain a joke. It just didn't work. But I'll guarantee it, if you listen and you hear it, when John's done, it'll make perfect sense. Now I have reached the age of judgment-giving sorrow that many men have come to, the verdict of regret, remembering the world once better than it is, my old walkways beneath the vanished trees and friends lost now in loss of trust. And I recall myself more innocent than I am, gone past coming back in the history of flaw, except Christ dead and risen in my own flesh shall judge, condemn, and then forgive.
Osama bin Laden is dead. I saw the movie. Anybody else see the movie? SEAL Team 6, get him at night, right? I remember where I was when the president came on and told everybody, we got him. If I'm going to be really honest with you, I have to say I have mixed feelings about it. Because on the one hand, I would be lying if I told you I didn't feel like some sense of relief or even a little bit of elation at the fact that someone who was so evil and someone who struck terror in the hearts of so many and someone who delighted in wreaking havoc on our world had been dispatched from this life into the next where he would meet his judgment. And there was a part of me that was really, you know, joined with everybody else and sort of celebrating that. But then shortly after that, I began to have other feelings. And my other feelings are actually related to the story we're going to look at today. If you have a copy of the New Testament and you want to look at some things, we're going to be in the book of Acts. So you can start finding the book of Acts. And that's a book that, I mean, the Church of Christ is supposed to own this book, right? Like, so you should know, right? You should have it. There should be a permanent indentation in your Bible where this is. Shortly after Jesus left the earth, his followers started to gain some traction with a really, really simple message. They didn't have a lot of flowery rhetoric back in the book of Acts. If you just read through the sermons, I know Scott McKnight was encouraging people to do that yesterday. If you just read through the sermons, you'll see their message is remarkably simple. And their message is, Jesus was who he claimed to be, and the fact that he was raised from the dead sort of validates that, or vindicates him. That was their message. That was it. Jesus made all these claims, and you didn't like who he was claiming to be or what he was claiming, and so you killed him, but God raised him back to the dead, which proves that he was right and you were wrong, and so that may have some implications for your life. You may have to work that out, but just know the simple message, Jesus was who he claimed to be, the fact that he was raised from the dead validates that claim. That was their whole message. You can see it if you look at Acts 2. Verses 22 through 24, and then down in verse 36, it's that message. Jesus claimed to be a man sent from God. You didn't like it, so you had him put to death, but God raised him back to life. Ha ha. Like, that's the whole message. That's it. And it has implications, and they would spend some time trying to figure that out, but mostly they just stuck to these facts. Jesus died. God raised him back to life. We all saw it. This isn't something that happened a long, long time ago in a land far, far away. We all saw it. We are all witnesses of it. And then this miracle happens when you get to Acts chapter 4. Peter and John, two of Jesus' closest friends, heal this crippled guy right on the steps of the temple. And they get in trouble for doing it. But they used it as an opportunity to preach their simple message. Peter is like Barney Fife as a preacher. He's got like one bullet. That's all he's got, right? But he uses it over and over again. And his one message is, it's in Acts chapter 3, verse 13. He starts in, Jesus was a man sent by God. He claimed to be the Messiah, and you didn't like it, so you killed him, but God raised him back to life. And so deal with that for a little while. And that's the whole message. And then thousands of people start to join them. And it looks like things are going pretty well. In the Bible, when things look like they're going pretty well, hang on. Because that's just a sign something is about to happen. Which I've also discovered that is true in my life as well. When things look like they're going pretty well, hang on, because something is about to happen, okay? So something's just around the corner. One of the leaders in this early church was a guy named Stephen. Stephen gets arrested, and he delivers this long and fiery speech, but he ends with this very familiar refrain. It's at the end of Acts chapter 7. He says, Jesus claimed to be the Messiah. You didn't like it, so you killed him. You had him put to death, but God raised him from the dead, vindicating and validating his message. You killed Jesus. God raised him up. Deal with those implications. And they decide to deal with those implications by throwing rocks at him until he dies. Which, that's a terrible way to end the service. That would be awful if we just decided tonight, when Jonathan Storman is done, we just throw rocks at him, you know? There were people, I think, yesterday who wanted to throw rocks at Sarah when she was done, but thankfully we didn't do that, because we're not that biblical. and the Bible tells us that there is a young man there named Saul. And we are introduced to him right at the beginning of chapter 8. That there's this guy named Saul there. Now, you didn't know this. Saul was crazy. Saul was just slap nuts. He didn't just oppose Christianity. What Saul wanted to do, he wanted to hunt down Christians and kill them. You guys remember the child catcher from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang? Saul was that. But for Christians. The child catcher used to freak me out when I was a kid. I had nightmares about him. He'd run it, you know, swing into town with that sweet truck, and he'd have that little whistle, and he'd whistle, and all the kids would come out, and I'd catch him. Saul was doing that for Christians. That's what he wanted to do. And then one day, Saul has this crazy thing happen. This is Acts chapter 9. I'm actually going to read these verses. Acts chapter 9, it says, meanwhile, Saul was still breathing out murderous threats against the Lord's disciples. He went to the high priest and asked him for letters to the synagogues in Damascus, so that if he found any there who belonged to the way, whether men or women, he might take them as prisoners to Jerusalem. And as he neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground. He heard a voice say to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? We don't have time to unpack this here, but just I want you to just think about this for a second. He doesn't say, why are you attacking the church? He says, why are you attacking me? That is how closely Jesus identifies with his church. And it has become really, really fashionable for people my age and younger to attack the church. And I want to say, the church may be in need of reform, but you better step lightly, young man, because when you attack the body of Christ, you are attacking Jesus himself, and he takes this stuff very personally. Okay? All right, now, who put that soapbox there? Who are you, Lord? Saul asked. Saul doesn't even know who's talking to him, right? Because he's blind. And he says, I am Jesus whom you are persecuting. Now get up and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do. This is the opposite of what Saul thought was going to happen. The men traveling with Saul stood there speechless. They heard the sound, but they didn't see anyone. Saul got up from the ground, but when he opened his eyes, he couldn't see anything. So they led him by the hand into Damascus. For 3 days he was blind and did not eat or drink anything. Jesus appears to this guy, knocks him off his high horse, strikes him blind. Saul has no idea what in the world is going on. All he knows is he used to be able to see, and now he's blind. And Jesus tells him, go visit a man in the next city, which is the city where Saul was headed to catch more Christians. He meets this guy. This guy prays for Saul, and eventually Saul is able to see again. And this is when Saul starts to think, you know, maybe my role in the Jesus movement is probably, maybe I'm a little misguided here. Maybe I should rethink what my role is here. Maybe murdering Christians isn't how I want to spend the rest of my days. And before you know it, look down at verse 19. The end of verse 19 here says, that if I can scroll down fast enough to get there, it says, Saul spent several days with the disciples in Damascus. At once, he began to preach in the synagogues that Jesus is the Son of God. He heard the message. And he starts preaching immediately. All those who heard him were astonished and asked, isn't this the man who raised havoc in Jerusalem among those who call on this name? And hasn't he come here to take them as prisoners to the chief priests? Yet Saul grew more and more powerful and baffled the Jews living in Damascus by proving that Jesus is the Messiah. And not only that, but Saul goes on to become like the best Christian ever. And in chapter 13, he gets sent out by this church to go start other churches. And he spreads the news about Jesus all over the world. And he even ends up writing most of the New Testament. This guy goes from being the worst man alive to being the most sought after teacher in Christendom. And he spends the rest of his days telling other Christians what it means to be a Christian. And he travels everywhere, and he tells everyone he meets about Jesus. And he has this crazy idea. He thinks, you know, one day, what I really want to do, one day I want to meet the emperor. Like the emperor of Rome. Because he has this crazy idea. Like if I could meet the emperor of Rome, I bet I could talk him into following Jesus. He just has that's illusions, delusions of grandeur right there. If I meet the emperor of Rome, I bet I could talk him into following Jesus. And if I could talk the emperor of Rome into following Jesus, how cool would that be? That's all he could think about is, I got to meet the emperor. What do I have to do to meet the emperor? He even goes to such lengths, he wants to get arrested, because he thinks if I can get arrested, I can appeal it up through the Supreme Court. Eventually, I'll have an audience with the emperor, and I'll be able to talk him into following Jesus. That's who Paul becomes. Champion of the gospel. Evangelist to the Gentiles. And we talk about this story all the time. And we talk about this story as if it's the most normal story in the world. But this story is ridiculous. This story is unbelievable. This story is crazy. And one of the things that makes it crazy is we just, well, you know, whatever. Paul dude goes from having Christians arrested and beaten and tortured and killed to actually being one of them. And this is the part that we skip over. And they accept him. No big deal. Whatever. There must have been somebody who was like, Saul, that guy killed my brother. I don't want to invite him to church. He's the guest speaker. I'm going somewhere else. I don't want to hear him. I want to go hear somebody I know, somebody I trust. Who thought this was a good idea? Normal people don't do stuff like this. But this is what we fail to see too often when we read the book of Acts. Christians are not normal. Christians don't do things normal people do. Christians do things like give money away. Normal people don't do that. Christians do things like tell the truth, even when it hurts. Normal people don't do that. Christians help people who can do nothing to repay them. This is not normal. Christians are called to be abnormal, to push against the trends of our surrounding culture when those trends come into conflict with the values of God's kingdom. And this brings me back to Osama bin Laden and my mixed feelings about his death. Could you imagine, just imagine with me for a moment, imagine how crazy it would have been if SEAL Team 6 had captured Osama bin Laden instead of killing him. Suppose they capture him and they bring him back to the United States. And when he gets here, he says, you know what? I think I was wrong about America. Like, they capture him and they put a bag over his head or something like that. And for 3 days, he's on a boat and he doesn't have anything to eat or anything to drink. And he's in there with only his thoughts, and he's rethinking his position about America and Americans. And when he gets here, he says, you know what, guys? I was wrong about this whole thing. I've realized the error of my ways. In fact, I'd like to become a citizen. Would that be okay if I became a citizen in the United States? And now imagine our government saying, sure. Why not? Sure, become a citizen, and all is forgiven. In fact, why don't you run for public office while you're at it? And he says, I think I will, and he becomes the mayor of Detroit. Right? Think about that. Osama bin Laden, mayor of Detroit. And he brings that once proud bastion of American industry back to life. And he becomes so successful at turning things around there that other civic leaders begin to seek his advice on what's the best way to run our city. And then governors start to call. And then the president asks him to serve on a special counsel, which would confirm a lot of your suspicions about our current president. And he goes down... And Osama bin Laden ends up going down in history as one of our greatest leaders and advocates for truth, justice, and the American way. Cue the music, unfurl the flags, light the fireworks. On second thought, hold everything. That would never happen, right? That's too ridiculous. That's too crazy. There's no way in the world that the American people would forgive him. There's no way in the world he would have been allowed to even visit America. There would have been riots in the streets. There's even less of a chance he'd be granted citizenship. Are you kidding? There's no way. There's even less of a chance that he would have been ever allowed to talk about running for office, let alone seeking a nomination, let alone winning an election. The whole idea is preposterous. And yet the earliest Christians allowed public enemy number one to reverse himself, to change his mind, to do a 180. You know, all this murdering and breathing threats and violence against the way, just take a mulligan on all that. We'll just pretend like that didn't happen. That whole hunt him down and kill him thing, it's... in the past. We'll forget all about it. They let him travel. They let him teach. They let him become a leader in the church. How in the world does something like that happen? Our fellowship, our tribe, our heritage, our non-denomination, I don't know what you want to call it, the churches of Christ, were built on this idea that the earliest followers of Jesus knew something that we don't know. That they were onto something that maybe we've missed. And so we work really hard to restore the practices and values of the earliest followers of Jesus. That's what we're trying to restore, the first century church. And so we've tried to organize ourselves the way they may have organized themselves. We try to have our assemblies modeled after what their assemblies may have been like. But there's a part that we're missing. Because the earliest Christians, the church of the first century, assumed that bad people can legitimately change. And I'm not sure we believe that anymore. The earliest Christians knew that a bad person wasn't destined to stay a bad person. Those people knew that liars and adulterers and, yes, even murderers could experience actual, real transformation because of the power of God that raised Jesus from the dead. And they refused to believe that Saul's past would define his future. They did not agree that the best predictor of future performance is past behavior. They believed that God could change people, that God wanted to change people. That God's greatest desire was to take depraved people and remake them into the saints they were designed to be. If you'd flip over a few pages or scroll a few scrolls or however you access it, go to the book of Ephesians chapter 1. Ephesians chapter 1 verse 16 says this. And this is, by the way, the Apostle Paul who wrote this. He says, "I have not stopped giving thanks for you, remembering in my prayers. I keep asking that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, the glorious Father, may give you the spirit of wisdom and revelation that you may know him better. I pray that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened in order that you may know the hope to which he has called you, the riches of his glorious inheritance in his holy power, and his incomparably great power for those of us who believe. That power is the same as the mighty strength he exerted when he raised Christ from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly realms." This is what the first century church believed, that the same power that was at work raising Jesus from the dead, vindicating and validating his message, was also at work in people like you and me and Saul and the worst person you can imagine. And because they believed that, they decided, let's give this guy a shot. Maybe they were skeptical at first. Maybe that's why they assigned Barnabas to him, you know, like a chaperone or something. Barnabas was a big guy. You know, and I thought, well, if he gets out of hand, Barnabas can just squash him or something. I don't know. But they were open to the possibility that the grace of God might actually be able to accomplish that kind of change in a person's life. And I wonder, have we lost that today? Have we stopped believing in a God who can and does change the very nature of a person? Do we still believe God may have been able to change Osama bin Laden's heart? Do we believe that? Or do we think, oh, well, that guy was too far gone. Like, that guy was just, had turned the corner, had gone around the bend, had gone so far out there. Who in your mind is so far out there that not even God could reach that guy? Who is it for you? Is it Howard Stern? Is it our current president? Is it the guy who was in that office before him? Is it the person you are afraid might win the office the next time around? Who is so far out there? Is it that person at work? Is it that woman who just is so irritating? Is it your sister-in-law or your mother-in-law? Well, let's leave mother-in-laws out of this. Who is it in your head who is so far out there? Who is enemy number one right now? And do you really believe that God is so impotent that he could not transform the life, the heart, the mind of that person? Is Hollywood so far gone? Is Washington, D.C. so far gone? Is Bahrain? Is Afghanistan? Is Iraq? Is the Middle East so far out of control that not even God could fix it? Because I'm telling you, the first century church would have not believed that in a million years. And because they didn't believe it, we sit here on the other side of the planet 2,000 years later and proclaim the mighty name of Jesus. Because they refused to believe that God's hands were tied when it comes to this person or this culture or that nation. What if we believed that God could still change people? I think that might be the game changer in our whole world.
reimagined a church in Texas where people who didn't like church could come to church. And a few weeks ago, a man named Junior showed up at our congregation, and he had been in and out of churches for a long time, and most recently been to another church in town. And I sent him an email, the same email that every visitor gets, and I had a little tag kind of personalizing it for at least the people that I met the previous week. And he wrote back to me and just had a catalog of failures. Everything that he had done, everything that people had told him that he had done, and he had been at this church for several weeks where he just felt like he was on the outside looking in. And I wrote him back and said, you know, here we've got everybody. There's nothing that you can say that you've done that somebody else hadn't already done. We're just not creative enough at our church to invent new sins. We just done them all. And so he was in a motorcycle accident the week after, and he was just healing up, and he'd been at this other church for a couple of years, just kind of on the fringes. And he came back last week and told us that no one from his other congregation, where he had been for years, contacted him at all, but several people from our church had. That doesn't make us hospitable. It doesn't make us particularly friendly. But the one thing that we try to keep in front of us is knowing where we would be without God. And not having any illusions about what our choices would be, what our nature is, what our temptations are. And there's something about that kind of self-awareness that allows you to open up to other people in a way that you can't have when you think, man, I'm a good church person, I'm a good Jesus person, and all these other people out there, they really need to get their act together. And so I'm imagining for you, there are some people in your life that you just think you're better than them. And that's what all judgment and exclusion are about. I wouldn't have done that. I don't think that way. My heart's not inclined that way. But I would bet that if I sat down with you for half an hour or an hour and we had a serious conversation, then we would know more about each other than we share with the world. And we would know folks like Osama bin Laden, folks like St. Paul, they're not all that different from us. And so God drops this story of the biggest terrorist persecuting the church. And actual persecution, not inconvenience that we call persecution these days. And says, I can do anything with anybody. And the church, I want you to trust what I'm doing with anybody. So Mary Carr came back to faith late in life, and she is an essayist and a poet, and this is her poem, Disgraceland. Before my first communion at 40, I clung to doubt as Satan spider-like stalked the orb of dark surrounding Eden for a wormhole into paradise. God had first formed me in the womb, small as a bite of burger. Once my lungs were done, he sailed a soul like a lit arrow to inflame me. Maybe that piercing made me howl at birth, or the masked creatures whose scalpel cut the lightning bolt to free me. I was hoisted by my heels and swatted, fed and hauled through rooms. Time-lapse photos show my fingers grew past crayon outlines. My feet came to feel spike heels. Eventually, I lurched out to kiss the wrong mouths, get stewed and sulk around. Christ always stood to one side with a glass of water. I swatted the sap away. When my thirst got great enough to ask, the stream welled up inside, some jade wave buoyed me forward, and I found myself upright. In an instant, with a garden inside my own ribs a flourish, there the arbor leaves. The vines push out plump grapes. You are loved, someone said. Take that and eat. You are loved and free to love the world. May you go in peace.